This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 24th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. We're going to take a look at what's been going on the past week in the area of federal taxes and see what's been going on. It's been a little more less, shall we say, hectic week than we've had in recent weeks with regard to taxes. We've seen fewer things happening. There haven't been nearly as many developments as there were in the recent past. But we'll go ahead and we'll start taking a look at what's actually been going on here. We're going to start out with a continuation of a story that we first talked about back in May of this year. That was when we had discussed the initial IRS reports that over 100,000 taxpayers had had data accessed via the IRS Get Transcript site. Now this week, the IRS announced that the number is actually larger than that. In fact, they announced that at this point, over 300,000 taxpayers had data accessed via that particular transcript website. That number, therefore, is up to triple what we had before. As well, the IRS, as with the last time we first did this, the issue was that we had 100,000 access and about as many accounts where people had tried to access the account but had failed to get through. The IRS announced that that continues in this case. So again, we've had basically twice as many, therefore in total, have had an attempt to access in some form. What's going on here has been the standard issue, and this is a problem that actually is a bit bigger than the IRS. So we'll talk about what's happening here. In this bigger case, to get on the Get Transcript site, taxpayers had to provide not only information from their tax return, but they had to provide access to what's called out-of-wallet information. Out-of-wallet information is information the IRS obtained from third parties, quite often credit bureaus, that had information for things like asking taxpayers where they had previously lived, sometimes who their neighbors were, sometimes asking taxpayers for accounts they'd had before, for who they'd had a car loan with when they had had some car years ago, asking them all this information that in theory only the taxpayer would know, and also is not contained in the IRS's computers. So even if the IRS somehow lost control of that data or somebody got in and got the IRS data, they'd be unable to get into the account because they wouldn't have the out-of-wallet data. What's happened, though, is that criminals have become better at handling this, and they're accumulating databases on everybody. And now it's pretty clear that this out-of-wallet information, which previously was thought to be a very secure way of assuring that only the real person could establish an account on a site that was high value, is no longer sufficient. Now, at this point, the Get Transcript site is shut down. But, as Brian Krebs pointed out in an article on his site, Krebs on Security, the method is still being used on some very high-profile sites. As he noted, some banks use this method as a way to verify that somebody setting up access on their website is actually the person who owns the account. As well, this method is used by the Social Security Administration for establishing an account on their website and, what was even most interesting, is still being used by the IRS if a taxpayer claims who's been issued an IP PIN, those are issued to taxpayers who have been the victims of identity theft. If they lose that IP PIN, you can get it reissued online, but you reissue it online by verifying you're really the taxpayer by, guess what, providing out-of-wallet information. That out-of-wallet information, therefore, continues to be a problem. What can we do about this? Well, for the moment, what the IRS is going to do is offer credit protection, essentially, to those individuals. And as we discovered last week, we noted the IRS has agreed that's not going to be a taxable event to those individuals when provided. The IRS is also going to contact everybody. Now, your clients who didn't have their data accessed, please remember, they're still going to tell you that they had enough information to get partway through, and that means they had enough information not just to get partway through, but also enough information that they felt relatively confident that there was a 50% chance they could get over this hurdle. Presuming they go to another website using the same out-of-wallet questions, it's very possible, because they'll be presented with different questions, at that time they may have the data to get it. This presents a rather huge problem as this out-of-wallet method continues to be used. So keep your eyes on this. This is something that's unfortunately likely to become worse rather than better as time goes on. But for taxpayers, some of your clients who get these letters, you need to be able to explain to them what's gone on, what the issue is, and what they can do at this point in terms of moving forward. If they get such a letter, just be aware that we know their data has been compromised. They will be given an IP PIN, but they certainly should start contacting credit bureaus and other institutions to verify that, in fact, they've not had other problems, because their data is definitely in the wild. Next up is a case of Tobias versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-164 that came out on August the 18th. In this particular case, there was an attorney who held an inactive CPA license. He had invested in an annuity, and he took funds from the annuity. Now, generally, what happens when you take funds from an annuity, if you take it before the annuity beginning date, it's presumed that the money that you take first comes out of earnings from the annuity, and that was the case for this taxpayer. However, the taxpayer had pointed out that he had bought the annuity with funds after cashing in stock at a major loss. He had a large capital loss carryover. He stated that, wait a minute, almost first thing is, I never really made money because, you know, I paid so much for that stock and I used that stock to buy the annuity. So basically, I'm just recouping the money that I put in initially when I bought the stock years ago. But number two, he said, hey, most of the income generated by that annuity came from the fact the annuity company sold stocks at gains, which is capital gain, and I should be able to reach inside and be able to offset my capital loss carryovers against that income that was realized. Unfortunately, as the tax court pointed out, that is not how Section 72 works. Section 72, annuities, great. No current tax on the earnings of the annuity. But the downside of it is that the earnings that are generated will all be treated as ordinary income. The fact that he had a large six-figure capital loss carryover wasn't relevant. Rather, what was relevant was he had ordinary income that was coming out to him on this annuity. Therefore, the tax court did not accept his view on this, ruled against him on both issues, and the taxpayer had tax to pay. Next up is the Ninth Circuit, who sustained the tax court in the case of Minnick versus Commissioner. This is currently reported at 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5137, affirming the tax court decision in the tax court case 2012-345. This opinion was issued on August the 12th. The issue in this case was the taxpayer had made a contribution of a conservation easement in land. Generally under Section 170 of the Code, this is one of those unusual cases where you can get a deduction for a contribution of less than a full interest of the property. As long as you give a conservation interest, a qualified conservation interest, in a piece of property that is preserved in perpetuity, you're allowed to take a current deduction even though you retain ownership of the underlying land. However, the law does require that it be basically retained in perpetuity and it be available to the charity in perpetuity. In this case, the land in question was subject to a mortgage held by a bank. The problem that we have in this case is the mortgage holder is in the first position. Therefore, if the mortgage holder decides, because the payments aren't made on the note, to take the land back, then the charity is going to lose that conservation easement unless the mortgage holder has agreed to subordinate its rights. It will take the property back subject to the conservation easement. In this case, the taxpayer had not told the mortgage company that he was going to make this contribution and, in fact, did not get subordination until actually well after the IRS exam began. The taxpayer claimed that, well, under the law, he really should be able to get this subordination at any time because he preserved it at that point. And secondly, it really didn't have an impact because he had rulings that said that basically a buyer would be concerned. Well, the court said, you've got a problem, sir. The plain language of the Internal Revenue Code requires a subordination before donation. As the court pointed out, we can't have this protected in perpetuity if somebody else has a right ahead of it who could come in, seize the land, and essentially seize it without regard to the conservation easement. Since the creditor had the right to land without such restrictions, the creditor had to agree before the contribution was made or it could not be preserved in perpetuity. Secondly, as the court pointed out, the IRS regulations stated the same thing. And the court held, even if you concluded that for some reason the law itself didn't require you to do that, which the court, remember, had concluded the law itself required that subordination take place, the IRS's interpretation of the law was not clearly unreasonable, and as such, under the rules that we've had since the Mayo Foundation case, the IRS regulation should be sustained as they represented a reasonable interpretation of the law. It's also important to note here that this means another circuit has come to the conclusion. Previously, the Tenth Circuit had come to the same conclusion in the Mitchell case. So both the Ninth and the Tenth Circuit have looked at this issue and both agree that any mortgage has to be subordinated before a conservation easement donation is made, or the taxpayer will get no deduction. So if you have a taxpayer making a conservation easement donation, make sure your client is better informed than this one. Make sure that, in fact, if there is a mortgage on the property, that discussions are held with the lender before the contribution is made, and the subordination agreement is in hand before the contribution is made to the charity, or the taxpayer will get no deduction whatsoever. Next up, we have a little bit of delay in the application of a new rule. This is found in Notice 2015-57, issued by the IRS on August 21, 2015. The Surface Transportation and Veterans Health Care Improvement Act of 2015, that's a mouthful, that Congress passed just before they left on their August recess, requires what's going to be conforming reporting by beneficiary, by heirs, and by the estate for the basis of assets. If an estate is required to file an estate tax return, the estate is also then going to be required to file with the IRS an information return and give a copy of that return to all heirs. That will tell the heirs what basis was claimed on the 706. Due to revision in Section 1014 of the Code, the heirs will not be allowed to claim a basis in excess of that amount on their return, or if the amount is finally adjudicated in the estate tax, the amount that's finally adjudicated in the estate tax exam for the value of that property. The problem was that this applied to all estate tax returns signed after the date of enactment, which means when the president signed it, a timer started running. And that rule said that the report had to be given to the IRS no later than 60 days after the return is filed or 60 days after the return's due date, including extensions if you got an extension. Obviously, there's been some 706s filed since July 31st. And that means a 60-day counter is running on those. And the IRS, as we're now sitting partway through August, realize that it's highly unlikely they're going to have all the reporting forms and everything ready for those estates to file when we get to the end of September. So the IRS has announced that, in fact, even though we have a 60-day deadline, the IRS is not going to require filing for any decedent with an estate tax return that was filed after July 31st. Those are the ones that have to file this report. They will be required to file basically no earlier than February 29th of next year. The IRS also specifically stated that until they actually get forms out and until they actually give us some guidance in this area, they are specifically requesting that estates do not file the information returns, nor do they give the information forms and the information reporting to the beneficiary. The notice asked specifically for individuals to give the IRS some guidance on how to handle this particular situation and to give the IRS some information about what type of reporting forms and what type of structures would make sense. Under the law, the IRS has the authority to require the form to be filed earlier than the 60-day period. So clearly one option may be that the IRS would have that form go in with the 706. In fact, that seems to be some of potentially what Congress was thinking, They gave the 60-day window in case the service wants to require a separate report, but they also have technically allowed the service to incorporate that into the 706 filing. So you need to keep your eyes open for what the IRS finally requires as well, if you have filed. And the catch is not whether a return was due. The question is whether it was filed. Even if on extension, after July 31st, that estate will have to file this reporting form with the IRS. You need to keep your eyes open for that form, and you need to remember that come next February, at the latest, you'll have to start issuing that report. So be aware and advise your clients and your executors about this issue that is going to be approaching to deal with this little matter. Next up, we're going to talk about Chief Counsel Advice, 2015-33012. This Chief Counsel Advice that was issued on August the 13th takes a look at whether county clerks, basically of a court, are going to be required to issue Form 1099 in three specific situations. The advice asks about the cases if certain things happen. For instance, the first case they asked about was, let's say that a garnishment is paid to the court. If somebody gets a judgment, there's a garnishment paid. That garnishment is then collected by the clerk of the court, and the clerk of the court turns around and makes a payment of that garnishment to the attorney for the individual who is to receive that garnishment payment. The question that came up was, does the county clerk have any information reporting requirement on a Form 1099 with regard to this garnishment payment? The IRS concluded in the Chief Counsel Advice that the answer would be no. First, under the general rule for 6041 reporting, which is the one that requires us to report payments in the trade or business for many activities, they determined that, in fact, the clerk was not actually the obligor, so the clerk was not actually paying it, nor under the third party rules, was the clerk actually in a position where they were going to essentially perform management or oversight functions, or have a significant economic interest in the payment. With neither of those being true, and the clerk not really being the party who was obligated, the clerk acted as a simple pass-through. They had no decision-making in this realm. They operated solely under the court order. With having no discretion to exercise, the IRS concluded that the clerk was not the entity that would need to file a 1099 in this case. But there's a second problem. It's being paid to legal counsel. And as we're all aware, under 6045, there are special rules for payments made to legal counsel. The IRS concluded as well that in that case, with the payment to legal counsel, they were, again, not an obligor on the payment. So they weren't the one making the payment. They weren't the one who was obligated to make the payment. They were collecting from that person. And they were neither the insurer nor a guarantor for that person. And those are the requirements where they'd have to issue the note to the attorney. So based on those rules, the IRS concluded that no 1099 had to be issued for garnishment. Next up, what about the case where the clerk's office repays to the attorney a refund? That was, in essence, refunded their client's money at the end of the case. So the client had paid money in, the money went into the court. At the end of the case, there was a refund issue. The IRS took a look at that situation to see if the county clerks needed 1099 that payment to the attorney. And it came to much the same conclusion. First, they basically concluded under the first scenario, the first test, that the only way that would be income is if somebody had claimed a deduction on it up front. And since the county clerk could not know if a deduction had been claimed, therefore could not know if it represented income, the 1099 rules generally do not apply if the party paying it cannot determine if the item should represent taxable income. Similarly, when we went to payments to attorneys, the IRS concluded, as with the last one, that this was not the obligor, nor was it a guarantor or an insurer of the obligor, so the payment to attorneys routine also did not apply, so no 1099 had to be issued in that case. Finally, we took a look at what happens if we receive foreclosure proceeds. So somebody doesn't pay on their mortgage, It's sold in a sale at the courthouse steps. The proceeds are received by the court, and the court turns around and pays that back out to the lender. Is the court obligated to issue a 1099-S for sales proceeds on real estate? After all, the county clerk collected the money for the sale, so aren't they operating very similar to like title companies, etc., that are basically clearing those funds and that we all know generally issue 1099-S's? In this case, the IRS pointed out that the general 1099-S rules do not apply if there is a transfer in full consideration of a debt, for instance, in a foreclosure proceeding. In this case, it is the lender who has a reporting responsibility on the 1099-A. There is no 1099-S to be issued. As such, the county clerk in this case does not need to and should not issue a Form 1099-S to report the sales proceeds. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 24th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. Be sure to join us next week for more developments here at Federal Taxes, and be sure to go to our website at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we're going to have posts to the links to all the information, all the source documents that we talked about here today, as well as information in the upcoming weeks on developments that take place during that week. And we look forward to seeing you again next week.